Let's talk about the restoration of this particular airplane.
This airplane, I've got photographs of it from since 45, and it went through, it was released by the military in 57, and went through a series of owners and parked out. So I've got one picture of it at Olathe, Kansas, where weeds are growing through the wings, and finally it was purchased by a gentleman, a series of gentlemen. Of course, that's a judgment call. But a series of gentlemen who eventually one of them put it into a total restoration where it was disassembled, taken apart into the major sections, engine, prop, nose section, fuselage, left and right wing, and torn apart, reskinned, new hardware, new everything. And that restoration was completed, fresh engine, bigger engine actually, and that was completed around 2002. And it won runner-up grand champion here in 2002-2003. It only has 370 hours on it since the total like-new restoration. And it is back the way it was originally, with the exceptions of the avionics in the cockpit. We think warmly about duplicating all the things that were nice about World War II. We kind of forget all the not nice things. But one of the things we don't want to replicate is the horrible safety record. So we update all the avionics. There were thousands killed in training and non-combat accidents in World War II before we got so sophisticated in the safety program. So this airplane's been totally restored, and then 9 months ago, it went to another Corsair specialty shop, John Lane's, in Jerome, downtown Jerome, Idaho, and Air Power Unlimited. And they went through the airplane totally again. We pulled the engine, went through it again. And then we, with the help of Bombs Away Company, we outfitted all the underwing ordnance here, you see. We also have another drop tank that we don't carry with us.
Sit down here and join me. Let's talk about what everybody came to hear about. Captain Thomas J. Hudner is a recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Doing my research last night, the medal was first commissioned by President Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. I think there are 85 living recipients of the medal. And, you know, I made a mistake 1 year up here. I called someone a winner of the Medal of Honor. And one of the guys in the audience corrected me. He said, no, they refer to as recipients. But in my mind, they're winners. Everyone is a winner. So I'm going to back that up. Thank you. Thomas Hudner and Jesse Brown could not have been from two more different backgrounds. Tom Hudner was born in Massachusetts, I think 1924, and went to various boarding schools, upper class schooling, Naval Academy graduate. Jesse Brown was from Mississippi, the son of a sharecropper. Now, does anybody here not know what a sharecropper is? You ever heard that term? I see some young people here. A sharecropper, after the Civil War and President Lincoln freed all the slaves, some of the black people didn't have a place to go work. And there was no money in the South back then because of the Reconstruction after the Civil War. So they became sharers in the crop. That's how they were paid. And they were called sharecroppers. And it became a pretty lucrative business because some of them became landowners and became very wealthy. So there was a lot of white sharecroppers after that. But anyway, Jesse was the first black naval aviator in history. And Jesse was a fighter pilot in VF-32. I know it, noisemakers. And Tom Hudner was his wingman. And they became good friends. And we're going to talk a little bit about the racial prejudice that Jesse went through and how Tom felt about him. Can you take it from there?
Yeah, that's a good intro. They couldn't have been farther apart. And Hudner ends up going to all the New England schools of the privileged, I guess you would call it, and then gets an appointment to the Naval Academy. In those days, well, not unlike today, Naval Academy, you're a naval officer first, aviator second. So Carl never quite mastered that. So as it was in those days, you had to do roughly a year of sea duty before you went to flight training. Jesse Brown was, I believe, ROTC, and he got his commission and went through flight training. And so oddly enough, even though Tom Hudner was a lieutenant junior grade in December of 1950 when this occurred, Jesse was still an ensign. So Tom had an extra year in service, but he didn't have as much flight experience. So the way the assignments on the flight schedule worked was that Jesse Brown would be the what they call a section lead, number three, in a four ship. So the flight leader would be the number one. Junior fellow on his right wing would be number two. Then the next most experienced fellow would be number three, and that was Jesse Brown. And then number four, junior guy in the whole flight, would be what was Tom Hudner. And you know, you hear a lot about the Tuskegee Airmen and the Army Air Corps' effort towards the last half of World War II to integrate the pilot ranks. The Navy wasn't having any part of it. And as he mentioned, the first African American naval aviator was Jesse Brown. And it wasn't until the Korean War that they actually saw action. So you have this, you know, the Korean, shall we go in the hostilities or?
Yeah, let me say a little bit more about Jesse. He went to Ohio State University, and at the time only 1% of the student body of Ohio State University was African American. And he went there, he was advised to go to an all-black college by his family and by a lot of other people. But he wanted to go to Ohio State. Why? Because his hero was Jesse Owens, the famous track star back in the 30s who embarrassed the greatest racist in history, Adolf Hitler, in the 1936 Olympic Games when he won four gold medals. And that's why he wanted to go to Ohio State.
So here you are, 1950, the Korean War breaks out. The USS Leyte is in the Mediterranean. They come back immediately. Jesse had maybe 5 days with his family. He had a wife and Daisy May and a daughter. And Hudner visited his wife, and within 5 days, they're off and gone around. Probably went through the canal, I'm guessing, and they show up. And their first, what we call line period, is December of 1950. The weather's horrible. The ground is horrible. The ground is rock hard. And there's a little event going on with the Marines called the Chosin Reservoir. And we're getting way outmanned by these tens of thousands of Red Chinese at that time, friends who decided to help out their Korean friends. And we're in a bad military situation. And so, of course, they call for Corsairs, and the Leyte launches eight Corsair F4U-4s, like you see behind you, two flights of four, and this particular flight of four is assigned to this one area of the Chosin Reservoir support. And during their runs, Jesse announces on the radio that he's losing, I believe it was oil pressure initially, and he's going to go down. Very mountainous area. I'm going to have Carl and Jim pass out. I had 100 copies of a great lithograph of this incident, which you can buy online. I wish I knew the name of the fellow. Maybe it's on the lithograph somewhere, but if you'd pass these around. And what happens is, of course, Jesse Brown goes down, his engine finally fails, and he lands in semi-mountainous terrain in a real bad spot. They're circling overhead, and they see this Corsair just pillowing, smoke and snow billowing up like a big cloud. You'd expect to see a downhill skier coming down the hill. And when the snow finally settles and the dust clears, here's the Corsair broken up a bit, and Jesse had opened his canopy, and they say, well, he's dead. And then upon further inspection, Tom Hudner drops down, and they see the canopy is farther open, and that Jesse is waving at them as they fly by. So he goes, oh, well, okay, he's alive. So they circle a few more times, and they determine that he's not getting out of the airplane. So they feel like he cannot get out of the airplane. So Hudner decides that he needs to crash land next to Jesse.
He thought for a while that he might be court-martialed because of that, to sacrifice a perfectly good Corsair for a guy that probably was dead anyway. But he did it because he was his friend, and that was the only hope he had. When he got to Jesse, he was trapped. The instrument panel had trapped his legs, and the airplane was smoking like it was about to catch on fire. He didn't want to sit there and watch his friend burn up in the airplane. So he had given Jesse his gloves and his helmet because Jesse was trying to get out of the airplane. He just threw his helmet out. And bear in mind, it's cold, and they're 6,000 feet up in the mountains. It's well below zero. And Tom Hudner reaches down with his bare hands and packs the airplane with snow to put the fire out.
So he realizes finally he cannot get Jesse free of the aircraft, and there's a little bit of wisp of smoke still coming from the engine compartment. So he runs back through snow, which was probably up to his knees, you know, no snowshoes or anything. So you can imagine how hard that was. And he's in flight gear, including what we call a poopy suit, which is a rubberized all-weather suit in case you go down the ocean, you'll last another 10 minutes. And gets back on his radio, which was still working, and the airplane says, hey, got to send a helicopter. Make sure he's got a fire extinguisher and an axe because I just can't get him out. Well, you got to remember now, this is the first use of practical use in combat of helicopters. They were an emergency when they launched just in peacetime. A lot of moving parts, all going roughly in the same direction. Just remember what the famous aviator said about aircraft. You know, an airplane, if left alone by the operator, is a fairly stable device and will fly itself probably better than the pilot. A helicopter, on the other hand, seeks to destroy itself if left alone. So here we have a helicopter, whop, 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 coming over the horizon, lands, and the crewman gets out, and they try to get Jesse out, and they just cannot get him out. Smoke's getting worse, and then coming over the ridgeline, you know, is half of the Chinese army probably, and so they decide they're gonna have to depart.
He passed away of shock before they could get him out of the airplane. My question for Captain Hudner, and maybe you can answer, Doug, is why did he do it? Was it because Jesse had suffered enough racial discrimination and he didn't want him to suffer anymore?
You know, he says that he never thought twice about why he was going to do it. He just never processed that, you know, through that logic tree. He said, you know, that was my friend and he needed my help. And he just said, I'm going down. He was almost court-martialed or captain's mast. And, you know, as someone said, a lot of the great medal winners do the wrong things. And this was, you know, in a lot of ways, it was the wrong thing to do. It ended up not being a successful mission. But he says, I just did it because he was my friend. And it's incredible. If you look at the plane, we have Jesse Brown's name on the left side, and then Tom Hudner's on the right side of the cockpit.
I've had the great honor of introducing a lot of famous airmen up here at Oshkosh over the years, and I met four Medal of Honor recipients, and they all are very humble men who just did their duty. And they all say, you know, I just did what anybody else would have done in that situation. They're all humble. I'm sure Captain Hudner's the same way. And God bless you, Tom Hudner, wherever you are, and I hope you get well soon. Okay, we're going to take a few questions from the audience. Does anybody have a question about Captain Hudner or anything? Doug, you want to take it? The gentleman right there.
Sure.
About the F-4U, later in the war, there were 4360-powered versions. What was the reason for that mod, and were the performance goals?
Chuck.
Okay, so his question is, if I paraphrase it correctly, later in the war there were models of the Corsair with a 4360 Pratt & Whitney, and were the goals achieved by the engine change and how, you know, how effective was it and everything. Actually, they didn't make it to the war. It was a Goodyear project. The designator was an F2G, and they made maybe Bob Odegaard's here, he's got one. Is Bob here? They made maybe five or six. There are still two around. One of them is in Arizona, and the other one will be at Reno, I believe, in September, if it doesn't make it this week, but the owner's here. Anyway, it's interesting, but the when you re-engine an airplane, if you increase the weight and the thrust, sometimes it doesn't end up working out too well. 4360 is an extremely complicated engine. It was the last, really, of the recips. Kind of convinced everybody why they needed to get out of recips. But it was a lot of maintenance, and the weight went up tremendously, along with the complexity, and the thrust went up. But it ended up being not a practical airplane, and the contract wasn't continued. Sir? The currency requirements to fly these days? You're not with the FAA or... Okay, all right. Yeah, you know, once a year, I mean... No, you need to be, of course, it's a single engine land, so you need to be current in accordance with FAR 61417, or whatever it is. In a single engine land, takeoffs and landings, and some of these aircraft, when they were restored, depending on the amount of parts that were used from the original airframe or the number of modifications that were done, will be licensed in a different category other than normal military aircraft or in the limited category. This one, for example, is in the experimental category. So if it falls under that one, you also have to have what's called an experimental aircraft rating, like a type rating.
Anybody else have a question? Explain the water injection on the engine and how that increases horsepower.
Yeah, the problem with trying to develop more horsepower is you eventually over-temper the cylinder, the combustion chamber. And so in order to develop more horsepower, you need to keep that temperature down. And so they will use either a water injection, which they came up with in the Corsairs in about 1943, and they would install a water tank and a water pump, or what we call now in Reno an anti-detonation injection, but it's a mixture of water and fluids. But you inject it into some place where it's going to get mixed well with the air. So normally they inject it into the supercharger, because all that air is then being mixed and inducted into the combustion chambers. And that coolness of that fluid mixing with the air keeps the temperature down, thus the chance for detonation goes down and you can extract more power. That's all I know about it, really. I read it somewhere.
That's pretty good. Anybody else have a question? Sir? How many flyable Corsairs are there now?
A year ago, I would have told you 19. We have two more that have joined the force. Jim Tobel's down the end of this ramp. And Kathleen, which won Grand Champion at the end of Oshkosh last year. So they're now 21 flyable out of 12,500, and there's probably two or three more projects, so the prospects of having a huge Corsair population are not very good.
Anyone else?
Great.
Okay, we're going to wind down now. I want to thank you, Doug, for coming today, and great explanation. Doug Matthews. How many veterans in the audience? Raise your hands. Thank you so much for your service. Thanks for watching Warbirds in Review.